Blog Talk Radio.
Can you believe it? January 5th, 2015. So glad that you could be here with us tonight, and welcome to everybody online listening to us and everybody in the chat room. So glad that you are here. And I hope you had time today to call your representative in Congress and ask them to fire Boehner. And if you didn't get a chance to do that today, you have a chance tomorrow morning to quickly go ahead and give them a call so that we can get in a good Speaker of the House that can actually do something that we want him to do. Without further ado, I want to bring on my guest, a very special guest. I'm so glad that he's able to join us today. It's Evan Sayet, and that's S-A-Y-E-T for those that don't know how to spell it. His website is evansayet.com, and he is the author of The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. And we want to talk a little bit about that, or actually a whole lot about that book. I was fortunate enough to read it over the weekend, absolutely loved it, so can't wait for Evan to share that with you. Just by way of introduction, I want to tell you that he is a writer-producer in his background. He's a stand-up comic. He's worked with such people as David Letterman, Arsenio Hall. He was on Politically Incorrect, and I believe wrote for that show with Bill Maher, which I'm sorry that he did, but he probably handled it better than I did. I would have. He's written screenplays. He was the writer for When Men Signs Money. He's been on C-SPAN, And let's see, he's been called by David Horowitz as simply the best political comedian working in America today. So, ladies and gentlemen, Evan Sant. How are you, Evan?
Hi, Susan. Actually, normally the right answer to how are you, no matter what, is I'm fine. But the truth is, I am fighting this terrible flu that's going around. And
oh,
so,
my gosh.
Yeah, I'm going to ask for a little leeway. I don't have a sneeze button here, and I almost can't hear myself in my own head, which is okay because I hear other voices in my head. But I like to hear what I'm saying as well.
Well, we totally understand. I'm just glad that you crawled your way to the phone and made it. So.
Well, fortunately, these days, you can bring the phone with you anywhere. If it had a cord, I don't know if I would be here with you today.
Thank God for mobile phones. Well, I wanted to, by way of introduction, I know I wanted to say that in 2007, you gave a speech at the Heritage Foundation that Andrew Breitbart deemed as one of the five most important conservative speeches ever given. And that's a pretty great compliment to get.
Well, you know, in addition to the compliment, what really means so much to me is two things. One, it is now by far the single most viewed and shared lecture in their entire history. Now, the Heritage Foundation is the think tank. And when Ronald Reagan would go to make policy speeches, he would go there. Margaret Thatcher, she would go and speak there. Of all the luminaries who have spoken at the Heritage Foundation, for my talk to be the single most viewed and shared lecture in their entire history, that means I really said something that stuck and people were sending to each other. And in fact, people were sending it multiple times or receiving it multiple times from various people. I remember when it started to go viral, National Review Online wrote, "This talk by Evan Sayet," and they linked to it, "This talk by Evan Sayet is cramming our inboxes. Please stop sending it."
That's pretty good. That's a very good compliment. I will have to say, too, Evan, in reading your book, I really enjoyed it immensely. So I want you to share with our audience that I know you use a lot of terms in that book, and you talked about modern liberalism. So if you could sort of explain there, maybe we can get started on what all that's about.
Well, first of all, let's define what a modern liberal is, because I struggle to decide what to call this actually unique ideology. It's not liberalism, lowercase l. In fact, it couldn't be more different. Liberalism actually stands for liberal values, whereas modern liberalism stands for no values. They are so open-minded that they don't even see evil as an evil, whereas John F. Kennedy, for example, a classical liberal, did see communism as evil because it was antithetical to liberalism. So I didn't want to use, let's say, Bill O'Reilly's definition or his name, which is secular progressives, because it sounds like there are eight of them in the entire country. Who's ever heard somebody say, "Hi, I'm a secular progressive"? Who's ever heard of the Secular Progressive Party or the Secular Progressive Movement? So I decided on liberal because that's what they tend to call themselves, and then I chose the modifier modern to show that they are not what they used to be or what they claim to be. In fact, it's a standalone ideology that has been around at least since Rousseau, but it's so ridiculous that it was overwhelmingly rejected by everyone but the very, very wealthy who can afford to be stupid, because stupidity is a luxury. Stupidity is a luxury. You can't afford to be wrong if you don't have more money, more food. You know, you can't be wasteful, you can't be stupid unless you have more. So it really only became first prevalent and then dominant after World War II for a reason that I think I have to be careful here, because I don't want to come off saying what I'm not saying. What I'm about to say is profound, not profound in that I thought of it, but profound in its importance. Think about this, Susan. From the dawn of time until just before we were born, every single human being, every single one, no matter where they lived, no matter in what time, no matter how wealthy, no matter how poor, every single human being had to be smart. That is, they had to be right in their choices. because horrific things could happen if you were wrong. Every single human being from the dawn of time until just before we were born had to worry about disease, hunger, poverty, physical pain, and war. Once
exactly.
we were born, what disease, what communicable disease do we have to be smart in order to avoid? Smallpox vanquished, chickenpox vanquished, polio vanquished, the flu, you know, right now the flu's going around. The flu wiped out two-thirds of a continent. Now you take Tamiflu and you bitch on your mobile phone while you're on talk radio. You know, so
what?
This, I'm sorry, just one more point. This ideology that is absolutely so moronic, it is akin to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, or the secular version, the five-year-old child in the kindergarten. It was rejected until now. Now you can be stupid and survive. You're not going to go hungry in America. You're not going to die of some horrible communicable disease. So this ideology really first became prevalent post-World War II and then dominant in our society and culture as the last of the great generations who had known things like poverty, hunger, war, and physical pain died off. And now we have generation after generation after generation that has never known these things, so they've never had to be smart.
And then we have, as a result, the entitlement generation, which, you know, those people that don't have to work.
Which, by the way, goes back to the Garden of Eden, where you were entitled to God's bounty, or the kindergarten classroom where you're entitled to cookies and milk without doing anything more than playing in order to have earned it.
Right, or an award for showing up.
Absolutely, all across the board, you know, whether it's your inflated grades, whether it's your lowered rent through subsidies, no matter what it is, we have totally divorced reward from merit. And
mm-hmm.
and that is really the link that links adults to the real world. When you're a child, you're rewarded without merit. When you're a baby, you're kissed and hugged no matter what you do. You reach a certain age, this relationship changes where, yes, you're still entitled to food, clothing, and shelter, but now you have to do some chores. Maybe when you become a teenager, you're entitled to food, clothing, and shelter, but you have to get a paper out and contribute some money. Then you reach adulthood where you're not entitled to anything except for what you've earned. But because the modern liberal is morally and intellectually retarded at the level of the five-year-old child, he never passes through the entitlement stage.
And you talk about two kinds of modern liberals. Can you talk about the differences and what those two modern liberals are?
Yeah, I mean, there's a utopian ideology behind this. You know, it just isn't in so many other ideologies. There are those who get the ideology of Nazism, and then there are those who have been brainwashed and propagandized into mindlessly following it. So I call the true believers the true believers, because I'm creative and original, and their utopian ideology is this. If we can eliminate the recognition of the better, we will have paradise. Because if nothing is better than anything else, then there's nothing for us to disagree about. I won't disagree with you about what's a better constitution, what's a better form of governance, what's a better religion, what's a better behavior, what's a better marital relationship. If nothing is better than anything else, then we'll have nothing to disagree about. If we don't disagree, we won't fight. If we don't fight, we won't go to war. Without war, there won't be any poverty. Without any poverty, there won't be any crime. Without any crime, there won't be any injustice. It's a utopian ideology that the true believers have. And all that's required to usher in this utopia is the rejection of all fact, reason, evidence, logic, truth, morality, decency, beauty, and everything else that you seek when you're a grown-up in order to recognize the better and pursue it.
Wow. It seems hard to believe, but it does explain a lot about what we see and you know, the PC, the political correctness that we have and where that really stems from. And
it's not so hard to believe if you just look at, well, first of all, it's been said point blank by a number of people on the left. But if you look at the modern liberal anthem, Imagine, John Lennon's Imagine. All right, imagine no countries. Not imagine all democracies. Not imagine all democratic republics. It's imagine no countries. Because in his mind, there is no difference between Nazi Germany, which created nothing but sorrow and misery and horror, and the United States, which has created the pharmaceuticals that have raised life expectancy to near 100. Imagine no religions. Not imagine good religions well practiced. No religion. So there is no difference between Islam and... So there's no fighting over what's the right moral code. There's no fighting over what's the right constitution. There's no fighting over what's the right form of governance. It's imagine nothing, which is what you have when you're in kindergarten or the Garden of Eden. So my book is called The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. Because at the age of five or in paradise, there are no countries. There are no religions. You just don't even think deeply enough to begin to understand, and here's the key word, and discriminate between the better.
Right. And it's like you said, it's kind of like you want to take the adult, if you will, and you're not allowed to have intelligent thought. It's just kind of go along, don't think about anything, don't discriminate, don't look at things and make a judgment whether it's good, bad, or different. Just kind of go with the flow, be neutral in a lot of respects.
Well, absolutely. And neutral is a word that I use sometimes, especially when talking about how this applies to the mainstream media, the difference between being objective and being neutral, because neutral is the same as indiscriminate. All right, the key here is that to the modern liberal, thinking is an act of bigotry.
The
concept behind that is that anything you believe, Susan, anything I believe, anything your listeners believe, anybody in the chat room believes, anything that anybody believes is going to be so tainted by your personal prejudices. Prejudices we all have. Prejudices we can't help but have is just part of being human. Prejudices based on things like the color of your skin, the nation of your ancestry, your height, your weight, your sex, and so on. Anything that you believe is going to be so tainted by your prejudices that the only way not to be a bigot is to never think at all.
It just sends chills down my spine.
But there's a second, that's actually the first law of what people started calling the unified field theory of liberalism. The way I write it in the book is that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative because its opposite is discrimination. But it's the second law that really flips things on its head. And I'll give it to you how it's written in the book, and then I'll explain if I may. But its indiscriminateness of thought does not lead to indiscriminateness of policy. Indiscriminateness of thought leads invariably, Susan, inevitably. There is no place else it can or has led but for the modern liberal to side with evil over good, wrong over right, ugly over beautiful, profane over profound, and failure over success. Why? Because if nothing, if no culture, no religion, no form of governance, no familial construct, no behavior, if nothing is better than anything else, then success is unjust. Why should a person, a nation, a culture, a religion, thank you. I love when people wow.
No other word to say at that point. Like, wow.
Yeah. You know, at a certain point, you just get used to it. I've actually scripted into my speeches now, wait for a while.
It's just amazing, though, to see the thought process, and you're really explaining it really well. I know there, we've been talking about the true believer, but there's also a mindless foot soldier. Can you tell us a little bit about that person?
Well, actually, I mixed my two just now. The true believer, seeking to create a world in which nothing is recognized as better than anything else, has brainwashed, starting with the kids in school when they're 5 years old. Again, why the book is called The Kindergarten of Eden. And the reason I say the modern liberal is morally and intellectually retarded at the level of a five-year-old child, the reason it's not three, the reason it's not seven, the reason it's not 10, is because something happens to every American child when he turns five. He enters the kindergarten. He enters the public and even private schools these days, but the leftist indoctrination centers. And from that moment on, he is taught nothing, nothing other than the rules of the what I call the cult of indiscriminateness, that thinking is an act of bigotry. If he strays from that, he is punished. He can be severely punished. He can go, you know, he can go to a re-education center if he dares to stray from the leftist dogma that nothing is better than anything else. He can graduate from college. Susan, he can graduate from graduate school being fairly illiterate and knowing almost nothing, so long as he toes the leftist line all the way through.
Well, and we see that now really clearly with Common Core. I mean, you know, it's a certain way of thinking. It's a way of thinking that the liberals, if you will, have said this is the way we want you to think, and it also kind of sets you apart from your parents because they can't think like that. They haven't been taught to think like that, but we can take this whole group of people, them this way, a certain way that we want them to think.
Well, there's another thing as well, which is I had this experience with raising my own kids, is you're put in a very bad position as a parent. My kid came home one day, and he was somewhat sad, and he handed me an award he was given. I don't know, most improved student of the week or whatever. And he said, Dad, why did they give me this? He knew he hadn't done anything to deserve the honor. And that put me in a place where I had to say, because your teacher is a schmuck. But now we have a problem because our values say teach, respect your elders. So they are forcing us to either keep our mouths shut and to have our children miseducated and indoctrinated, or to undermine our own values, which, by the way, is one of the reasons Saul Alinsky said one of the rules for radicals is make us live up to our own values, because they have none.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, too, when you talk about the true believer in your book, I know you describe it as believing in total regression back to the first days on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But that gets us back to paradise. If we the utopia, you know, if we do that and we sort of regress backwards. And I was thinking about a total regression. Some of the things that I've seen in the news is like, you know, the global warming and the climate change is pretty much like that way. You know, you can't use your car anymore. We want you to use a bicycle instead. And
absolutely. But think back to some of the original, back when the revolution was first taking place, when the first babies born into this world without disease, hunger, poverty, and physical pain, who then became the children of the 60s, who then became the professors of the 80s, and the journalists of the 80s, and the Democratic Party of the 80s, think back to when they were naive enough to actually try to sell us on their slogans. And what were their slogans? They were all infantile regressions. They were, if it feels good, do it. That is the antithesis of what a grown-up says. What a grown-up says is, if it is good, do it, and then engages his mind to discover what is good, and then pursues it. Let it all hang out. That's the Garden of Eden. That's a 5-year-old, excuse me for this, you know, playing with himself in his room or whatever. All right.
Right.
So in fact, the it's such a good word, and I'm not going to be able to grab it in my head because of my flu. Otherwise, I would have. But the song from Woodstock called Woodstock. The line that they sing is, "We've got to get back to the garden." That was their call. That is, but as they recognized that other people weren't responding to their idiotic call to infantilization, they then became more clever about it. But if you go back to their original sloganeering, what they were and still are trying to sell, just now in a different package, is we've got to get back to the garden.
Now, you also talk about, you've talked about age 5 as being significant. You also talk about in your book the age 30 as being significant. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, what they have done is expanded childhood all the way in, literally, technically. I forget if the NIH or which official government organization changed the definition of adolescence so that it now ends at the age of 30. So you're still a child until you are 30 years old, according to the official government definition. And if you remember, the slogan back when they were telling the truth was, don't trust anyone over 30. Why? Uh-huh. Because 30 is when you finally left your parents' home. It's when you finally left high school, college, graduate school. It's when you've actually entered the real world. And once you enter the real world where they're not going to reward you for doing nothing, they're not going to reward you on the basis of your self-esteem needs, where you actually have, there has to be a relationship between merit and reward, and people over 30 are going to come back and tell the kids on the college campuses, hey, guys, what they're teaching you in women's studies or in ethics, what they're teaching, it's not real. It doesn't work. It's devastating.
Right.
And that organization you're talking about is the National Academy of Sciences that actually has the official definition as 30 is the age of adulthood. It's when adolescence.
How wonderful is it that I have so much going on in my life that I need the host of the show to tell me what's in my book? I love that.
You know, I read it.
Yeah, I haven't in a while.
No, I totally get that. I also, one thing that you said in your book, and I really liked, you said children who question authority become the authority. And aren't we seeing that today?
Right. I mean, that was another one of the slogans, question authority. And, of course, you, at a certain age, question authority. But by what basis does a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, by what basis do they recognize who is actually authoritative and who isn't? So it's just a truism. If you question authority, you then become the authority. And at a certain point, you have a certain right to, when it's your money, when it's your life, when it's your time. But when you're a 5-year-old child or even younger, I think the example that I gave, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Susan, in the book, was a local preschool whose advertisement was, at this particular school, your child leads the way. How does a 3-year-old know where to lead? No, adults, grown-ups, you lead the way.
And this, to me, it reminds me of Occupy Wall Street, because you take these kids that you've always told, you're the leader, you're the authority, you know what to do, da-da-da-da-da.
We're the people we've been waiting for.
Right. And it grows you into the entitlement of an adulthood. And then you're also, because of the mindset of the modern liberal, you don't know how to basically do anything because your growth, your maturity level has been retarded, if you will.
No, that's exactly the word I use, and it's been retarded the level of a 5-year-old child, which I don't know. There's two different ways I can segue here from that question, but it's one of the reasons that liberals so overwhelmingly flock to industries where you don't really ever actually do anything. If you think about the industries that we associate with liberalism, there's academia, there's journalism, there's entertainment, and there's Democratic Party politics. Right? The academic doesn't build anything. He doesn't make anything. There's nothing tangible. He doesn't wire a house for electricity. Why? Because if you build things and you don't know what you're doing, you can get hurt. If you wire a house for electricity and you don't know what you're doing, you can get shocked or electrocuted. You could die. But if all you do is talk for a living, and that's what academics do, they lecture people who have never done anything, lecturing to children who have yet to have done anything. So the two people who don't know anything lecturing about how evil the people are who do things and make things. You know, it's not, like, let me just add to that very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a coincidence that the grown liberal and the small child share the same ideology. The only ones who are evil are those of us in the middle where we don't work. Well, I do, but, and I was a modern liberal, by the way, for the longest time. You know, being in the entertainment industry doesn't mean you don't have intellect. It just means that you don't need intellect because you're not doing anything. You know, to figure out the actor, his job is to pretend to know what he's doing. When he's flying an
right.
airplane, he doesn't know how to fly an airplane. He's pretending to fly an airplane. You know, so and the journalist, well, the journalist just reports what other people are doing. The six firemen put out a fire today. They don't put out the fire. They just report to us. So every industry that we associate with liberalism is in what I call the rhetoric industries. All talk but no action.
I know, and you bring up Bruce Springsteen as an example there. Can you tell us why you brought him up?
I was coughing and didn't want to cough in your ear, so I put the phone down. All I heard, no, I coughed in your ear anyway. I heard Bruce Springsteen. So what about Bruce?
I asked why you brought him up, and kind of if you could tell your audience a little bit about why you brought him up and what you talked about in your book.
Absolutely.
About him.
You know, it is very easy for us. On our side and on their side, to simply reject the other side as evil or stupid. But you can't do that with Bruce. And I am the world's biggest Bruce Springsteen fan. In fact, I mean, there's no way to quantify this that I'm aware of, but I honestly believe I am the world's foremost authority on the meaning of Bruce Springsteen's lyrics. He is that important to me in so many ways, and yet he is a brain-dead liberal whose policies follow to perfection exactly how I describe the modern liberal. So it was important to me to include somebody who's not evil and not stupid and show how this applies. But I also bring up Springsteen because he's been dubbed the working man's troubadour. If you really want to understand the plight of the working man, then you need to understand Bruce Springsteen's lyrics. The problem, of course, is that Bruce Springsteen has literally never once had a job. He knows nothing about working. In fact, so what he has is the five-year-old mentality, the thinking of a man-child about what it might feel like if he were to ever have a job. All right, I'm hearing some kind of crackling. Is that from your side or my side?
I don't hear it at all, so it may be from your side.
Okay. All right. Or maybe, yeah, that's fine. That might just be fans going, Bruce.
It's Bruce Springsteen cutting you off, okay? He's had enough.
He's got that power. But what's interesting about Springsteen is when he sings about interpersonal relationships, I think he is as important as there is anybody out there. But when he delves into two areas, one being politics and the other being having a job, this working man's troubadour, now again, I know his catalog as well as anybody. I can't name you a single song where somebody with a job isn't going through a living hell. I mean, they have lost their soul. They have lost their identity. In fact, it is so bad that they are on the verge of committing violence. All right, I'm going to sing a song for you. He sings, I do my best to live the right way. I get up every morning, go to work each day. But oh, remember, I've got a cold. But your eyes grow blind and your blood runs cold. If you have a job, your eyes grow blind and your blood runs cold. Sometimes I feel so weak, I just want to explode. Explode and tear this whole town apart. Take a knife and cut this pain from my heart. Really? Because you have a job, Bruce? Really? You're going to cut your heart out because you had to go to work that day? But if you're a small child, imagine the horror and the angst when you're playing and your mom says, hey, playtime's over, come in and do your chores. Oh, take a knife and cut this pain from my heart. It's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. He's got another song where he goes, end of the day, factory whistle cries. Man walks through these gates with death in their eyes. All right, two things there. One, man, all right? The guy doesn't even have a name. He's just man. He's been stripped of his identity, and he's got nothing but death in his eyes because he had a job, Bruce? Because he went to the office, Bruce? He went to the factory, Bruce? He's got death in his eyes? All right, and then the next line is, and you just better believe, boy, somebody's going to get it tonight. Really? You're going to go home and beat your kids because you got a job? But that's what the left thinks. That's what the left thinks.
Well, and it's, you know, it's like Nancy Pelosi, you know, with Obamacare. She didn't want anybody to work and basically said, hey, you know, this Obamacare is going to give you an opportunity to work maybe part-time or not work at all and go out
well,
and do the things
she said
that you really want to do.
Right, go follow your passions. Go follow your
right.
passions just like they believe a kindergartner should, just like
mm-hmm.
you would do in the Garden of Eden. It is exactly what they believe, and that's exactly what everyone from Bruce Springsteen to Nancy Pelosi to it's my stuffy head, but Bing Crosby, Stills, and Nash is singing Woodstock. It is what they believe. They believe that there are two things that man mankind lost when we fell from paradise. One was that we had to now use our intellect in order to seek out the better. If we were going to survive, Adam and Eve didn't need to use their intellect to seek out the better. God provided the welfare. All right. In kindergarten, you don't have to use your mind to recognize the better because your parents and the schools and your teachers provide you with the food and the crackers and the milk and everything that you need. Two things you need to do as an adult. One is to use your intellect to seek out the better, and two, toil to bring it about. So liberals believe if you can eliminate those two things, intellect, the use of one's mind to seek out the better, and toil, then we will return to paradise.
And they think people like the Tea Party.
Wait, Susan, I scripted in there. You said, I scripted in there a while.
Yeah.
All right, that was a call back to earlier. Okay. Uh-oh, did I lose you? Okay, there you are.
No, there.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying that and they believe people like the Tea Party, who are just the opposite, are like violent people on the verge of, you know, of killing people, right? I mean, if you have a job and you're actually doing something.
Anybody with a job is, first of all, is a sucker. Why would you work? And that, by the way, I believe was Thomas Sowell's phrase, that the left sees anybody who has a job as a sucker. Now,
mm-hmm.
you can have a job so long as it's your dream job and you get to do what you want to do. I mean, Bruce Springsteen, you can say, has a job. You can say Sean Penn has a job. You can say, you know, Nancy Pelosi. But as far as a job where it's not super high paying and where people don't yell out your name and bow to you and where they don't kowtow and where, you know, but if you have a real job, you have been oppressed. Why don't you have a better job? Wage slave.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You're a wage slave. Yep. There you go. That was in the script.
and you talk about people too, like George Clooney. Even people like George Clooney are considered victims.
Right. Everybody on the left is a victim. You know, one thing that blows our mind, it is somewhat understandable why those, because let me take this a step back.
Mm-hmm.
There is a canard that is sold by the leftist media and the leftist education system and the leftist entertainment industry and the leftist politicians that the Democrats are the party of the poor and the working people, and the Democrats are the party of the rich and the very rich. The Republicans, if I didn't say that right just now. The truth is, as everything is with the modern liberal, exactly the opposite of that. The Republicans are the party of the working poor and the working class. The Democratic Party is the very poor and the very rich, the very, very rich, and the very, very, very rich. If you look at the top 10 uber-wealthy communities in America, the top 10 uber-wealthy zip codes, places like Sutton Place in New York, Bel Air in L.A., Nob Hill in San Francisco, Hyannisport, et cetera, 9 of the 10 uber-wealthy communities are not only overwhelmingly Democrat, but they're overwhelmingly even further to the left than that. So it's easy to understand why the very poor might feel victimized. They just might not feel the opportunities are there. People don't like to blame themselves for their own failures. But how do you explain Michael Moore showing up at Occupy Wall Street when he's one of the 1%? You know, how do you explain it? How are they the victims? And here's the answer. When you don't do anything, then nothing bad can happen. So anything bad that happens in this world isn't caused by the people who don't do anything. If there's any pollution in the world, it comes from those poor saps who drill for oil. It comes from those poor saps who create. If there are any side effects to a pharmaceutical, it's not from the guy pretending to be a pharmacist, you know, or in the pharmaceutical industry. So because the liberals who are uber wealthy don't do anything, they feel victimized by any pollution that's out there because they know they didn't cause it. They feel victimized by any drug that doesn't work 100% with 100% effectiveness because they know they didn't create it. So anything bad that is in this world has to have been created by those of us who live in a world that is wonderful but far from utopian, where drugs do have side effects, where if you want to drive your SUV or caravan of SUVs, Al Gore, you need oil. But again, the people who don't do anything, the ones who work in the rhetoric industries, they're convinced that anything that is less than utopian has to be the cause of somebody else because they know they didn't do it.
Well, and you mentioned, and you have a chapter called The Emboldened and the Beautiful, and I like that. I like that title. You talk about how the modern liberals would like to have us quickly, you know, eliminate the beliefs that we have, but that they can't do that, so they go into Plan B. Can you talk about a little bit about their Plan B?
You're going to have to remind me, actually. I mean, I it's been a while.
It's been a while. You basically talk about you want to eliminate the evidence that emboldens people and their convictions.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, again, going back to what the true believer believes, that it's not evil beliefs that causes evil. It's any beliefs that causes evil. So their goal is to eliminate the recognition of better and worse, good and ugly, but most importantly, evil and good. So what they need to do, they need to eliminate the evidence. They can't eliminate the fact that some things are better than others. All right, and I don't tend to talk from a religious standpoint, because if you don't believe in the Bible, then saying to somebody, the Bible says, if this person you're talking to doesn't believe in the Bible, that's not going to hold any water. But so the thing that's great about the Bible and morality is they're invariably practical reasons. You know, the reason that the Jews have been so successful wherever they are throughout time, so long as they're not being horrifically oppressed, is because there is something tangibly better about following the Ten Commandments. If you don't steal, then you have there's more harmony in the community, you can cooperate, but whatever. So I tend to make my arguments in that way. And because the better behaviors do tend to lead to better outcomes, what the liberal has to do, since he can't change the fact that the better is the better, he has to eliminate the evidence, the wealth that comes from doing the right things, the prosperity, the happiness, all the other things that come from doing the right things. So he needs to punish the successful and reward the failed so that they appear to meet in the middle.
And do you remember you had written about in the third law, you talked about that sort of rewarding the lesser and punish the greater is kind of how I sum it up, and maybe you summed it up even better than that. But you talked about The View and the time that Bill O'Reilly was on the show. Do you remember that part of the book?
And And I believe the third law says something to the effect of the modern liberal will ascribe or must elevate the evil he ascribes to the innocent to exactly
right.
the level of evil he is invariably championing. And so, yeah, Bill O'Reilly goes on The View. Now The View is a perfect liberal show. It's four people who have never done anything declaring themselves experts on everything.
Right.
Right. Okay, so Bill O'Reilly goes on The View, and he simply states a fact. He says, on 9/11, the Muslims attacked us. Oh, my goodness, they were outraged. It was high dudgeon. Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar, two of the most unhappy people in the world named Whoopi and Joy. All right, they march. They march off the stage. I don't know that I've seen that three times in my career. Maybe when Louis Farrakhan was on a show, and Bill O'Reilly simply stated a fact, and that outraged the left. Because facts outraged the left. Anyway, Barbara Walters coaxed them back on, and they said, "Well, is every Muslim a terrorist?" Which is ridiculous. If your standard of something being true in this imperfect world is 100%, then nothing is anything, which is, again, the liberal nihilism perfection. Nothing is anything. O'Reilly was able to slap that down. My example is, does every cigarette cause cancer? Does every drunk driver have an accident? No. But there's something about cigarettes, there's something about drinking that makes more likely these things, and there's something about Islam that makes it more likely an airplane's going to end up in your conference room.
Right.
That being said, they went to the next trope. Yeah.
Right. No, go ahead.
They went to the next gambit, which was to say, well, what about Timothy McVeigh? Now, notice here the standard is if you can name 6,000 Islamic terrorists, that's not enough. But if you can name one Christian, that proves it. But here's the
right.
thing: McVeigh wasn't a practicing Christian. He didn't create. He didn't commit his atrocity in the name of Christianity. The Christian community was outraged by his act, as opposed to the Muslims who danced in the streets. But in order to prove that Islam isn't evil, they needed to prove that Christianity is. Because if Christianity doesn't create terrorists, then there's something wrong with Islam. They started with their goal, not of the truth, which might be ugly, which might be unfortunate, but is true, that there's something about Islam that creates terror. But because the modern liberal is not allowed to recognize evil, he must defend it by elevating the evil he ascribes to the good.
Just so contradictory to everything I believe. So it's so hard, but it makes sense.
It's 180 degrees. And, you know, I didn't come up with the phrase unified field theory of liberalism. After people started watching my original talk, I started getting emails. I'd say I got 30 emails from separate individuals saying, you know what you have there? You have the unified field theory of liberalism. Which, by the way, Susan, when I went and gave that original talk, I was a complete political unknown. In fact, I wasn't even yet in politics. I was still a Hollywood producer and writer. The reason that it went so viral, remember, everybody in Washington has a speech that they give every day. Everybody in Washington has a book they've written, a book they're writing, an article. Everybody does. How this talk by a then totally unknown, wonkish speech to a half-empty room of eggheads became this huge thing is because I answered a question that everybody has. How can liberals be so stupid? Why do they reject fact and reason and invariably argue on the side of evil? And I answered it in a way that once you understand the unified field theory of liberalism, you've answered everything makes sense, all the way up to why they sided with Michael Brown. They saw the video of him strong-arming this store owner. They saw the facts. They know the facts. They know the truth, and they're willing to lie. Hands up. Don't shoot. They're willing to lie in order to side with the thug over the good
right.
and decent cop who had no choice.
Right.
And this book, The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks, which is based on that original talk, answers that question in a way that is completely satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely, because it was always my contention with liberals, too. They look at the truth, they have the facts right in front of them, and yet they're willing to say, no, it didn't happen, no, that's not true. And it's like, how can you say that when everybody, unless you're totally blind, can't see it? But it you explain it very well.
The second part of that is that it's always to the benefit of evil, failure, and wrong. And they're not evil people. You know, you can understand why evil people, and there are some who are evil. I think Al Sharpton is evil. I think Louis Farrakhan is evil. You know, there are some evil people. But what's telling is there is absolutely no difference between Al Sharpton, Louis Farrakhan, and the President of the United States, or Elizabeth Warren, or de Blasio in New York. All right, they will all ignore the facts. You know, all the President of the United States needed to do was say, folks, his hands weren't up. All right, and that ends everything. And yet the President of the United States is not just willing, thrilled to foment racial hatred, violence, even the murder of two cops in order to advance his agenda. How do you explain this? And again, I do.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, it's this thing you were talking about, too, with the president. He takes a book from Hugo Chavez, and he, you know, bows down to the Saudis and goes, it, for me, it goes around on a apology tour of the United States. I mean, what we're talking about.
Absolutely. America is the world's great evil. Why? As proved by our success. You know, Obama was asked, do you believe in American exceptionalism? And he gave a very clever, very politic answer in which he said, yes, I do. But then in the next sentence made it clear that no, he really doesn't. When he said, yes, I believe in American exceptionalism, just like I'm sure the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism and the Brits believe in British exceptionalism. So in other words, his belief in American exceptionalism as it is not based on his intellect. It's not based on, well, we have a superior constitution. It's not based on, oh, well, our Judeo-Christian heritage gives us a leg up. It's not our Protestant work. It's basically an act of bigotry. Rah, rah, I live in America, so I love America. If I lived in Great Britain, I would love Great Britain. If I lived in Greece, I would love Greece. But here's the problem. That's the first law. He's not allowed to use his intellect to recognize the better. But the second law is this. Okay, if America isn't exceptional, how is someone like Barack Obama and those who share his ideology, how are they to explain not only America's success, which would be unjust if we're not anything special, but given that we are the most successful nation in all of human history, someone who doesn't believe in American exceptionalism has no choice but to conclude that America is the greatest injustice in all of human history. So it becomes Barack Obama's job. Social justice demands that he tear us down, that he make us weaker, that he make us poorer, because it's not fair if we're nothing special.
Right, and that's why we need to, if Ebola is breaking out someplace else, we need to bring it here so that we can also share in what human beings have caused, right?
And we can't have drilling off the coast, but we can finance drilling in Brazil. And go back to a reference you made earlier about global warming. That's the entire point of this phony global warming thing, is that the more successful you are, the more you'll be punished. The less successful you are, the more you'll be rewarded.
And it begs the question, is Barack Obama a true believer or a mindless foot soldier?
Well, the truth is there is absolutely no way to tell the difference, because there is absolutely no difference in the rhetoric or in the policy, whether you are doing this because you believe. I mean, I think I quote Zinn. I know I quote Zinn, Howard Zinn, right at the very beginning.
Right.
Objectivity is undesirable. Objectivity is impossible. It is also undesirable. Does he reject objective facts because he finds them undesirable because he's a true believer? an ideologue, or does he reject objective facts because he believes objectivity is impossible in an act of bigotry? I don't know. It makes no difference. There is no difference in the policy or the rhetoric, whether you're a true believer, whether you're a mindless foot soldier, or, by the way, there's a third category, which is just a pure prostitute, just somebody who sees money to be made. You know, maybe Al Sharpton, I don't know if he's a true believer or a mindless foot soldier. I believe he may just be a prostitute. He sees money to be made in lying.
And maybe there could be a little bit of all three, you know, in one person, because you get the same results, you know.
Right. It makes absolutely no difference. I think the example I gave in the book is Michael Moore's movie Fahrenheit 9/11. Did he lie against America because he's a true believer and he wanted to tear down, make the better look worse and Sodom look better? Or did he do it because he starts with the notion that there is no difference between Saddam Hussein and America and then cherry pick the facts? It would make no difference. In the end, you would have exactly the same movie.
Well, again, we have about 4 minutes left. I want to ask you really quickly. You refer to yourself as being a 9/13 Republican. What is that all about?
I grew up, I was born a New York City born liberal Jew. It wasn't an ideological liberalism. It wasn't that I had been raised to read Das Kapital or the Communist Manifesto and decided that I was on the left or compared liberal ideology to. It was just what my friend Andrew Breitbart would call the default factory setting for somebody born into that demographic. I knew growing up what all liberals know, that Democrats are good and Republicans are evil. I knew I was good, therefore I'm a Democrat. You know, I knew that Democrats like peace, Republicans like war because it's good for business and they're racist. Well, I like peace, so I must be a Democrat. You know, I like health, I must be a Democrat. I like air, I must be a Democrat. But 9/11 didn't surprise me. That's why I don't call myself a 9/11 Republican. Obviously, I didn't know the dates, I didn't know the targets, the carnage sickened me. But I knew, even as a brain-dead liberal, just enough about the world to know that the same people who were murdering the Jews of Israel for no other reason than that they were the closest infidels, and who were murdering the Hindus in India for no other reason than they were the closest infidels, and who were murdering children in Beslan, Russia for no other reason they were the closest infidels, would, when they could, come and massacre the big infidel, the great Satan. What really surprised me was what I metaphorically call 9/12. That's the days, the weeks, the months, and now the years after 9/11, and the liberal response to the attack. The notion that we deserved it, that it was, in the words of President Obama's spiritual mentor, the chickens coming home to roost, and this notion that the way to prevent future attacks was to be nicer to the terrorists. This was insane to me. And so I had to understand how it was that the good, smart people, my people, were not only siding with evil, they were defending religious fanatics. Weren't we supposed to hate religious fanaticism? They were defending religious fanatics in the mass murder of Americans in the most secular, multicultural city in the history of the world. This was insane. And so I had to begin to think, and Susan, I have an expression. The first time you think is the last time you're a Democrat.
I love that. I'm going to remember that forever. I really like that. Evan, I'm gonna have to end it with you pretty soon here. Thank you so much for coming on. Everybody needs to go out and get The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. It's an excellent book. You want to read it. You want to share it with your friends. And you want to change liberal lives by getting it, understanding it, and sharing it with everyone. So I thank you again for coming on, and I hope you get better.
All right, Susan. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Evan. Take care. So, seriously, you really need to get the book and read it, because we just touched on it tonight. But Evan has a lot of good YouTube videos out there, and his website is evansayit.com. He is one of those sought-after conservative comedians. So fortunate to have him on the show tonight. You're going to be seeing him everywhere. He's been on C-SPAN, and like I said, David Horowitz called him simply the best political comedian working in America today, with the emphasis on working in America today. And I'm so glad that you were able to join us tonight. We're going to have some extremely great guests continuing here in January. Hope you'll come back next week at the same time, Monday at 6 o'clock. And until then, take care and God bless.